From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
For the past several weeks, Leonid Redonia and I have been talking about how to solve our problems of our state.
I'd like to focus on what has united us over the past 2 days rather than what's divided us over the past 2 years.
2 years where we disagreed much and worked to find the worst in each other.
What they're doing is they're banking on, in the most cynical way, they're banking on the fact that we give a damn and we won't turn our backs on these clients, we won't shove them out into the streets.
I was not elected to help preside over the financial destruction of this great state.
Impasse politics do not work. Do you have the votes? You do not have the votes.
I think that politicians on both sides, they have kind of taken some of the messaging to the extreme.
This is a 2x4 smacked across the foreheads of the people of Illinois.
He risks a strike that would shut down state government.
This election isn't just about beating Bruce Rauner.
Bruce Rauner's policies have failed, and the state's worse off as a result.
Well, there's definitely a dissatisfaction with the status quo.
I am not in charge. I'm trying to get to be in charge.
He's betrayed our party. And you know what? You cannot buy back trust after a betrayal.
The shooter who hunted down many of us, politics became his religion.
One woman described a terrifying encounter when a legislator followed her to a hotel room, pinned her against the wall, and forced himself on her after she said no.
Well, it was quite a year in state government and politics. We saw some accomplishments, a lot of dysfunction, even some stunning testimony. It all started with Governor Rauner in control of Republicans at this time a year ago. But as this year comes to an end, is he losing his grip? We saw the end of the budget impasse, a big change in school funding, and a lot of people willing to throw in the towel when it comes to serving in the legislature. We'll recap the year that was on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and I'm joined by Charlie Wheeler. Charlie's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. In our Statehouse studio, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter. And joining us today from the Chicago Tribune, reporter Monique Garcia. And Monique, good to have you on once again.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start with the state budget, because that really did dominate the headlines for certainly a couple of years and all the way through the first half of 2017. The fight that resulted in the fiscal standoff finally came to an end. And I have to say, at this time last year, I would not have bet on that happening, Brian.
No, and I think I would have agreed with you, and we could probably go in the archives and find us saying that, because it just seems like the divisions had become so intractable between Governor Rauner and the Democrats, and each had dug in their heels, and the governor wasn't going to budge, and he had, as you said a moment ago, an absolute grip on the Republican Party and the legislature. And what eventually happened, spoiler alert, is it took as many as 16 Republicans breaking with the governor to join with Democrats to finally pass a budget. But, you know, six months of this calendar year, which, you know, culminated in after 2 years of budget impasse in order to get there.
It really was a dramatic and kind of stunning turn of events. I think, as was mentioned, a lot of folks were speculated on both sides of the aisle that this impasse would last for another 2 years, for all of Bruce Rauner's term. In fact, Democrats said that that would likely happen, and Bruce Rauner said that he thought that that was the writing on the wall. But really, we just saw this frustration kind of bubble over, and people who previously were loyal to the governor were willing to take these risky votes to buck the governor and buck the party just in the interest of moving the state forward.
And it was the start, Monique. Doesn't it seem like it was the start of what has been a very tumultuous few months for Governor Rauner in his leadership position with Republicans? It seems as though that was the breaking point, and we've seen a lot of things happen since.
Absolutely. It was the breaking point, and it was a very huge public embarrassment for the governor that caused a lot of internal turmoil in his administration. After that happened, he blamed advisors around him for not helping to keep Republicans loyal to him. He ended up firing much of his top staff and his communication staff, brought in some new people from the Conservative Illinois Policy Institute, That didn't work out well, had to fire some of those folks. So it really has been a very bumpy year for the governor, and it all started with Republicans willing to break with him on the budget and on a tax hike.
And Charlie, before we move on to other discussion about this budget, let's go back to around this time last year. We were hearing rumblings of what was known as the grand bargain, that the Senate was working both Republicans and Democrats together. So, you know, people that sit there and think, well, nobody was doing anything. They were just sitting on their hands. There was movement. There did seem to be people trying to get something done. That eventually, of course, fell apart, too.
Yeah, over the last Christmas holiday, Senate President John Cullerton and then Republican leader in the Senate Christine Redonio actually got together without involving the governor, without involving House Speaker Michael Madigan, and tried to forge an agreement to move forward. And they came out with a package, I believe it was a dozen or so pieces of legislation that had things in there that Democrats didn't like, had stuff in there that Republicans didn't like. But in kind of a throwback to the way things happened in the past, it was a compromise. It was an agreement. I understand that you have concerns and issues that are important to you, as do I. I'll respect yours, you respect mine, and we'll move forward. And from all accounts, as they started to move forward with Senate votes, the governor weighed in and said, no, I don't get enough out of this, so we're going to tube it. And
although it's important to note, Charlie, that the governor did so behind the scenes. Publicly, he was still saying,
sure,
as he was embracing the grand bargain, and he actually budgeted $4 billion. There's a $4 billion hole in his budget that was basically a blank space, said grand bargain to be inserted here, which, you know, counted on a tax increase. But he was, you know, even though he still denies it, he was going and talking to Republicans saying, you know, we need to get a better deal for this.
And I think that's sort of the
hallmark of the governor. He's not willing to settle for half a loaf. And my history of watching Illinois government, and I go back, yikes, almost for a quarter of the state's history, nobody ever gets everything that they want. There's always compromises. We're a diverse state, regionally, politically, culturally, and you have to reach accommodations. And in my mind, the Republicans who broke with the governor and voted for the budget did so because they were doing what I envision lawmakers to do, and that is representing their constituents. The budget impasse was causing great damage to their communities, and so they said to the governor, I'm sorry, governor, but on this one we have to stand up for our constituents rather than for your agenda.
Monique,
I was going to say that I think that some of the governor's private positions on this really did lead to that division within the Republican Party, because particularly in the Senate, you had some lawmakers led by Leader Redonio who were looking to cut a deal and who at many times got very close with the governor. And then you had others who were more aligned with the governor's thinking about holding out for reforms, who insisted that, you know, we can wait, we can wait, we can wait. And you really did see this fissure open up within the Republican Party on that front. And it came down to, ultimately, you know, the governor said that he would support an income tax increase, but he wanted it either to be temporary or to come along with a freeze in property taxes. When it looked like there might be a deal there, then he said, you know, well, I can't really sign on to that unless we get some workers' comp reform, which is something that Democrats really aren't open to, but were willing to consider. So it just seemed that nobody really wanted to make a deal happen when it needed to happen.
And Brian, when we look back,
let me cut in though.
Oh, sure.
Monique, don't you think that Redonio and Cullerton were serious about wanting to make something happen?
I think they are, but it's their members who have to vote on it. And it was their members who ultimately were divided, particularly in the Republican Party.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you can see that when, after Leader Redonio left, in installing Bill Brady as her successor. He is widely known to be much more loyal to the governor. And so at the end of the day, a lot of members abandoned Leader Redonio and weren't standing by her when she was trying to make this deal. And that is because of a fear of retribution from the governor. The governor helped revitalize the Republican Party. He has put a lot of money into these races. And there was some concern about walking away from that, especially after you had stayed loyal to him for 2 years or more.
We certainly saw a lot of problems develop in the state with not having a budget, and I think we can talk more about those, but I think one of the things that people wondered about was, you know, how the state was maneuvering without a budget, and that was one of the questions we received from a listener.
Hi, I was wanting to ask a question on State Week. I'm Scott Thorne from Carbondale, and I was wondering just how was the state able to function for almost 3 years without passing a budget? Thanks.
And we hear all this talk about a federal shutdown of government, you know, the possibility of those things happening. And surely that's not what happened here in Illinois.
No, it's not. And part of the reason is that there were a couple of critical areas that without funding would have caused the state to shut down. It would cause a dramatic explosion, if you will. One would be elementary and secondary education funding. Well, the legislature did pass full-year budgets for K-12 education in all of those years of the impasse. The other would have been if state workers weren't being paid. A circuit court judge in St. Clair County ordered the state to pay state employees even in the absence of an appropriation. There were also a number of consent decrees, which were the state agreeing, generally in federal courts, to settle suits that, yes, we'll go ahead and provide these services. Those continued even without specific legislative authorization through a budget. And finally, the law itself requires that some payments be made no matter what, budget or no. One is the state's contributions to the pension systems, and the other is the debt service, what we have to pay on money that we borrowed in the past. So that's a huge chunk of the state budget that's kind of covered on autopilot. On the other hand, as we heard in the clip, you look at the damage done to the social safety net and to human service programs that weren't covered by consent decrees. A lot of people really suffered and lost their jobs. Higher education, another area that was not covered. And so the universities had to reduce staff, had to cancel programs, lay people off. Students had to defer their education when their MAP grants weren't made available towards the end of the impasse. So there was a lot of damage done in certain areas, but because of these court orders and the way the statutes are written, other areas carried on as though there were no problem at all.
And the bills, of course, the backlog went up quite a bit. And Brian, when we look back at that, Charlie mentioned earlier that these people who broke from the governor and helped support getting a budget approved were supporting their constituents, yet many of them heard from some angry constituents, especially when voting for a tax hike.
Yeah, there were several lawmakers who said that their personal phone numbers were put out, or at least phone numbers were published that connected directly to their personal cell phones, and so they were getting calls and threats at all hours of the day. I know at least one I can recall who told me he'd gotten a death threat from this. And we saw an amping up of primary opposition now. A lot of these lawmakers who voted for the tax increase, particularly on the Republican side, have decided not to seek re-election. And the ones who were a little slower to come to that decision, there were rumblings that they would be primaried by conservative interests out there. So it's definitely something that cost them politically. But as you said, Sean, and I think as we've all said, this is something that they said they felt they had to do. And I think that we also can't downplay the threat of the junk credit rating. That was something that was cited a lot. Illinois already has the lowest credit rating in the country, but if we were rated junk, I mean, that could create a negative credit spiral. The functioning of government could, you know, eventually grind to a halt. We do move a lot of money around all the time. There's constant borrowing from the markets. That's something that people said, you know, would really be just a terrible thing to happen.
I believe that's what Representative David Harris was referring to in our earlier clip about the financial destruction of the state.
Right, because and so it's important to note that as part of the budget agreement, there was a big borrowing component to that. So as lawmakers were debating this and facing the possibility of junk, they knew that in order to start to get the state's fiscal house in order, that they'd have to borrow. And it's really hard to do that and more costly to do that when the credit rating is so poor. Illinois already has the worst credit rating in the nation. And so part of how the state functioned for so long without a budget is this huge racking up of bills. When Bruce Rauner came into the office, there were about $5 billion in bills. At the end of the summer, it went to a high of $16 billion. It's now gone down, but that's because of borrowing. So that means that providers, human service agencies, even people who provide, you know, toilet paper to prisons, they're finally starting to get paid after waiting, in some cases, more than a year for services that they've already rendered.
Brian, another thing that did get approved this year, something that I don't think many of us expected would be able to get through, certainly in the partisan atmosphere of the Capitol, was education funding changes. A new formula was put into place to help poorer schools. Can you give us a quick overview of that?
Yeah, changing the system of funding schools in Illinois is something that people have wanted to do for decades down here. They've worked on it for a long time, and I think as part of the kind of dam breaking of the Republicans breaking with Governor Rauner, it was, you know, something that was able to get done this year. It also helps that Democrats kind of wrote the budget in such a way that you really had to change the formula, the funding formula for schools. It kind of forced the issue. But this new system is supposed to target state aid to schools that have higher levels of poverty, lower property values. But the governor did, even though he campaigned against it earlier in the year and called it a bailout for the Chicago public schools and had lots of nasty things to say before he kind of came around to signing it eventually, and now touting it as one of his top accomplishments of the year, he says. He did also get a private scholarship tax credit in this bill. So unions and some Democrats say this is kind of a stealth way of creating vouchers in Illinois. It's not really a voucher system, but it will mean that less tax money comes to the state that will instead be going towards private schools.
But in my mind, that to me represents the way the system should work. Yeah, the public school advocates absolutely detest the school choice, these private scholarships or vouchers, whatever you want to call them. But on the other hand, they looked at the rest of the bill and they said, okay, despite this private school tax credit, we're going to support the overall bill because it's a well-designed plan based on what specific needs exist for each school district. When you look at the type of kids who are there, the demographics, how many kids are learning English, how many kids have special needs, how many kids are low-income kids, how many kids live far away from school. So this particular school district, here's how much money it needs. How much can it raise locally? If it can't meet its adequacy level, the state will step in. And any new money that comes for education in future years is going to be allocated, something like 90%+ of those dollars will go to the schools that are farthest away from their adequacy level, rather than have the kind of one-size-fits-all formula that we've been operating under for the last 20 years.
Well, 2017 is going to be remembered as the year of this Me Too movement, in which a lot of women have come forward to talk about harassment, even sexual assault. And Illinois was not immune to that at the Capitol. We actually had some pretty stunning testimony that took place at one legislative hearing. Monique, give us a little bit of background about what we've heard in state government, and are they doing anything about it?
Well, this really came to the forefront in Illinois when we had a victims' rights advocate testify in committee that a lawmaker, Senator Ira Silverstein, had sexually harassed her while she was trying to get a bill passed. As part of this, it prompted a series of changes. The state now requires lawmakers and lobbyists to take sexual harassment awareness training. But throughout this process, it was discovered that there was really no way for women or men who have been victims to come forward with a complaint. The woman who made this allegation said that she had told Senate President John Cullerton's office about this more than a year ago and hadn't heard anything. They said, yes, we received this complaint. We went through our internal channels and recommended that this be investigated by the legislative inspector general. The problem being that there hadn't been anybody in that post for several years. So it wasn't just, you know, sexual harassment complaints that weren't being investigated. This could even be improper campaigning on state time. There was just nobody in that office to look at these claims. So since then, a special IG has been put in place. There may or may not be a report soon, kind of giving an update on where things stand on this backlog of cases. I think there were about 30 cases or so that are probably sitting on her desk. So I think that a lot of questions remain about what this means moving forward. There was swift action in this narrow sense, but there are larger questions about how you address this culture in the Capitol moving forward. There's concerns that once the spotlight is off of this, that it'll go back to, you know, business as normal. So there are a lot of, a couple of legislative committees looking at how to further push these changes and make sure that that this is something that women don't have to deal with in the Capitol.
We've seen allegations that have really ended political careers at the national level in Congress. But Senator Silverstein, we should point out, has denied that he has harassed this woman, and then also has stayed in office. I think he did step down from his leadership position in the Senate, but he is running for re-election, so we do want to mention that. Let's move on, though, to some legislation. We talked the budget. We talked education. There were some other bills that made it through, and a couple of pretty controversial ones, and Governor Rauner has faced the wrath of conservatives for going along with a couple of these bills. One is known as the Trust Act. Brian, give us the brief idea of what this is about.
Yeah, this is something that Democrats and law enforcement groups and the governor who came together to put this thing into law say it's meant to foster trust with immigrant communities and law enforcement. Right. The idea is if you're a victim of crime, given how all the movement towards deportation we've seen nationally, that people are afraid to come forward. The idea with the Trust Act is to get people to come forward. Conservatives, however, say this is, you know, sort of makes Illinois a sanctuary state, which is a very hot button topic among the, you know, that demographic. And so people have been very critical of the governor for going along with this legislation.
And then, of course, we had a bill that basically allows public funding of abortions in the state of Illinois. And that's another one the governor signed. And that seems to really be one that may have moved the needle a bit more for conservatives. He now even has a conservative opponent in the primary, Representative Jeannie Ives of Wheaton. So the governor really getting it from both sides, both from the Democrats and even from the conservative wing of his own party.
Yes, Republicans said that this really was the last straw for a lot of them who had been upset with the governor throughout this budget process. The bill initially was put forth as by Democrats in response to some action that they saw at the federal level in the Trump administration. The bill broadly was designed to remove a so-called trigger action, which would mean that if the federal government repealed, or if the judges repealed Roe v. Wade, that would also repeal abortion rights at the state. And Democrats didn't want that to happen. But as part of that, they included an expansion of taxpayer funding of abortions for poor women who are on Medicaid and for state employees who receive health care through state insurance programs. And the governor initially had said that he would veto the bill. He told Republicans this. He told some advocates with the Catholic Church this. But as the months went on and as the pressure built, he changed his mind. And he eventually said when signing the bill in a very kind of somber ceremony that he had to stick with his personal beliefs and that he didn't feel that it was right to deny women access to this kind of health care.
And when he campaigned for election, he signed, I don't know if he actually signed a formal pledge, but he said that he agreed with the action that he ultimately took. In a survey by one pro-women's choice group. And I think when we heard Representative Ives talk about him at the start of the show, talking about him betraying, part of it was his signing of the bill, but part of it, too, was the fact that he lied to people about it.
And that seems to be something that seems to be getting her some traction. We were even hearing some lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, who I would consider party establishment, some congressmen and others who have basically refused to come out and endorse Governor Rauner, at least at this point in a primary election. Brian, that's kind of surprising to me.
It is. I mean, at this point, and I don't... I was thinking about this. I wonder who are the governor's advocates? Toward the end of the year, he went before the Chicago Tribune editorial board, which had been very supportive of his agenda in the past and supportive of him. And even they have begun to be very critical of him. He's gone, and I should add, Monique obviously has nothing to do with the editorial side. I'm just mentioning that this is like, who are his big supporters now? I mean, the Illinois Policy Institute, who he went to and brought in a bunch of their people to be his staff when he had the first shakeup over the summer. The head of that called him Benedict Rauner, which, play on Benedict Arnold, which is what State Representative Ives has really picked up on. She calls him that in almost every public appearance now.
It feels like he's the man without the country right now, doesn't it?
Yeah. And he definitely seems to, in his public statements, seems to really genuinely feel beleaguered and sort of victimized, I think, is the only word that really comes to mind.
Well, Democrats will have their own battles going on. They have a crowded primary for governor. We know it's going to be an expensive year, maybe likely the most expensive election certainly in the state's history, and maybe one of the most expensive state elections in the U.S. history. J.B. Pritzker, at least it seems to be right now, the front runner on the Democratic side, but there are others there who are still making some noise. And another surprise this year we got was Attorney General Lisa Madigan deciding that she would not run again. She's been in office or will be in office for 16 years when it's all said and done. And Charlie, that was a little bit of a shocker to me, too, that she's not going to stick around.
Yeah, it was, because I personally think she's done a very good job as Attorney General. But I would also add that being Attorney General is sort of an easy job to do, in the sense that you get to pick and choose a lot of what you're involved in, and you can always be the good guy. You can go after people who are scamming seniors on home repairs. You can go after credit card and identity theft people. You can go after the home mortgage industry. You can go after student loan abusers. And so she's done this, and she's been very aggressive. She's brought a lot of money into the state. She's been quite an advocate for open government, so she's got a very good record. And I guess she may have just decided that it was time to spend more time with her family. And maybe another thing would be her way going forward is sort of blocked by the fact that her father is the House Speaker. I know she's referred to that in the past when there was talk about her running for governor. She said she didn't think it would be appropriate for a governor and a House Speaker to be of the same family.
I just want to add one contrary footnote to what Charlie was saying about Attorney General Madigan's aggressive pursuit of her job. There's one area where she was not very aggressive, and I think it extended the budget impasse. She did not seek to enforce the Illinois Constitution, which says, for a long time anyway, which says that only the legislature can appropriate money. That judge in St. Clair County was personally responsible for billions of dollars in state spending, I think prolonging the impasse. But we'll never probably get that decided. She's on her way out now.
And it opens a door for somebody else possibly in that office, maybe even Pat Quinn, the former governor. He is among those who are running in the Democratic primary. That's going to wrap it up for our year-end review. I want to thank our panel once again, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Monique Garcia with the Chicago Tribune. And thanks to everybody for listening throughout the year. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and find us on NPR One. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.